Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Big Book of Ghost Stories by Otto Penzler. Read by Joel Richards and Amy Landon. Introduction. Otto Penzler. Tales of the supernatural have been a fixture of the storytelling tradition since pre-literate times, and the most popular form they have taken is the ghost story. This should not be at all surprising, as the fear of death and its aftermath has abided in the breasts of humans ever since they became cognizant of what it meant to no longer be alive in the manner in which it is traditionally understood. Animals, down to the most primitive invertebrates, share this fear without precisely being aware of what it means in a conscious sense. But they nonetheless do all they can to stay alive. The question of what follows the extinguishing of life probably does not keep mosquitoes or squirrels awake at night. But more than a few Homo sapiens have pondered their uncertain futures with trepidation in the dark of night. All cultures on the planet have superstitions about the dead returning as spirits or phantoms. Belief systems memorialized in drawings and writings from the very beginnings of civilization. In the Egyptian Book of the Dead, departed people are shown to return, not merely looking as they did in life, but dressed in similar garments. Therefore, apparently not only do dead people have the ability to materialize, making themselves visible again after they are gone, but so do textiles, leather, and metal. In the Bible, the story of King Saul calling on the witch of Endor to summon the spirit of Samuel has been recorded, as have the questions surrounding whether Jesus, after his resurrection, was a living being or a ghost. From ancient texts in Greek mythology, various types of ghosts are described in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, and Romans, notably Plutarch and Pliny the Younger, wrote about haunted houses. Literature of all eras abounds in ghost stories. William Shakespeare often used ghosts in his plays, most famously in Hamlet and Macbeth, and Charles Dickens wrote the greatest pure ghost story of all time in A Christmas Carol. Others among the world's greatest authors who have written in the genre include Ben Jonson, Horace Walpole, Jane Austen, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Guy de Maupassant, Edgar Allan Poe, Wilkie Collins, Edward Bulwer Lytton, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Henry James, Edith Wharton, Oscar Wilde, Willa Cather, F. Scott Fitzgerald, well, really too many to continue. What is the great attraction of supernatural fiction in general, and the ghost story in particular? From the time of childhood, we have a fear of the dark, and rightly so, as we don't know exactly what is lurking out there, wrapped in the black cloak of invisibility. Although it frightens them, children still love to hear scary stories at bedtime. Just consider such fairy tales as Hansel and Gretel, Rapunzel, and Little Red Riding Hood. We never outgrow our love of fairy tales, even if in adulthood they take a more complex form as stories about vampires, serial killers, werewolves, or terrorists. Ghost stories may be told in many different tones and styles, ranging from the excruciatingly horrific to the absurdly humorous. Ghosts, after all, may have widely divergent goals. Some return from the dead to wreak vengeance. Others want to help a loved one. Some are the spirits of people who were murdered or committed suicide, and so could not rest because their time officially had not yet come, and therefore walked the earth instead of stretching out comfortably in their graves. Some were playful, enjoying the tricks and pranks their invisibility allowed them, while others delighted in their own cruelty, committing acts of violence and terror for the sheer inexplicable pleasure of it. All these ghosts, and more, appear in this volume. You will meet ghosts who frighten you, who make you laugh, and for whom you will feel sorry. And they are true ghosts. I have tried to remain true to the notion that ghosts are spirits or specters of the dead. Some stories that frequently have appeared in other ghost story anthologies have nothing at all to do with ghosts. They may be trolls, or evil plants, vile fungi, monsters, or other creatures of that ilk. Rightly or not, I have attempted to be a bit of a narrow-minded purist about it all. Not that it created a problem. There have been an astonishing number of outstanding ghost stories written by some of the finest authors who ever dared allow their dark creations to be set down on paper. It has been a confounding challenge to select the stories for this, the biggest collection of ghost stories ever compiled. It was tempting to include all the great classics, but that would have filled to overflowing even this gigantic tome. It was equally tempting to stuff the pages with little-known stories, often every bit the equal of the cornerstone titles. But it is impossible to attempt to produce the definitive collection of ghost stories and omit M.R. James, Algernon Blackwood, H.P. Lovecraft, or Edith Wharton. Although I admire some of the supernatural tales of Henry James, especially The Turn of the Screw, he won't be found here because that novella has been anthologized to death, is easy to find elsewhere, and is so long that a half dozen other stories would have had to be sacrificed. Putting together an anthology is not a pure science, so there are contradictions galore. I've included The Monkey's Paw, for example, which has also been anthologized to the point of being a cliché. Still, it's short, didn't use up too much space, and it is lively, unlike dear old Henry James, no offense. To make up for the very familiar stories, I've included some that you've never seen before, several of which appear in book form for the very first time. The golden age of the ghost story, the late Victorian and Edwardian eras, is fully represented, and so is the golden age of the pulp magazines, the 1920s and 1930s, while the contemporary masters have not been ignored. Whether this collection is best enjoyed next to a summer campfire or a winter fireplace is up to you. On the other hand, it is so enormous that it may endure through several seasons. Whenever you listen to it, I hope you have a shiveringly good time with it. After all, in the dead of night, who would not believe in ghosts? Although I read more than 1,000 stories to find and identify those that I hope you will most enjoy, it would not have been possible to compile such a comprehensive and wide-reaching volume without the invaluable assistance of those who know a great deal more than I do. Sincere, if hopelessly inadequate, thanks are owed to Robert Weinberg, John Pelin, Chris Roden, Gardner Duzois, Joel Freeman, Harlan Ellison, John Knott, and those I'm forgetting who so freely and generously offered their assistance and expertise. But I'm not dead yet. Mr. Arcularis, Conrad Aiken. Although Conrad Potter Aiken, 1889 to 1973, wrote well-received novels and about 40 short stories, it is his poetry that has provided his primary literary reputation. He wrote his first poem at the age of 9 and, 4 years later, memorized a volume of Poe's poems, strongly influencing his early work. He was later devoted to the work of John Gould Fletcher and T.S. Eliot, changing his poetry to a more modern, imagist style. His novels, notably Blue Voyage, 1927, are reminiscent of James Joyce. Aiken's most important book was The Selected Poems of Conrad Aiken, 1929, which won the Pulitzer Prize and the Shelley Memorial Award. Born in Savannah, Georgia, he was the son of an old New England family and attended Harvard, then moved as a child to New Bedford, Massachusetts, later settling in Cambridge. His father, a brilliant but erratic doctor, took his young son to witness an eye operation, and later killed his wife and himself while Conrad was still a boy. When World War I broke out, Conrad refused to serve, successfully insisting that writing poetry was an essential industry. Among his most important prose works are the novel King Coffin, 1935, in which a man plans the perfect crime because of his hatred for humanity, then fails to commit the act. The disturbing short story, Silent Snow, Secret Snow, in which the protagonist wages an internal battle with reality and a frightening fantasy, and Mr. Arcularis, both of which were published in his collection, Among the Lost People, 1934. Mr. Arcularis was originally published in the March 1931 issue of Harper's. Aiken later adapted it as a play, produced in 1949, and published in 1957 by Harvard University Press. It was further adapted for several television dramas, including as episodes of Studio One in Hollywood, June 25, 1956, ITV Play of the Week, September 8, 1959, Great Ghost Tales, July 6, 1961, and as a made-for-television film in West Germany, which aired April 8, 1967. Mr. Arcularis, Conrad Aiken. Mr. Arcularis stood at the window of his room in the hospital and looked down at the street. There had been a light shower, which had pattered the sidewalks with large drops. But now again the sun was out. Blue sky was showing here and there between the swift white clouds. A cold wind was blowing the poplar trees. An itinerant band had stopped before the building and was playing with violin, harp, and flute. The finale of Cavalleria Rusticana. Leaning against the windowsill, for he felt extraordinarily weak after his operation, Mr. Arcularis suddenly, listening to the wretched music, felt like crying. He rested the palm of one hand against a cold window pane and stared down at the old man who was blowing the flute, and blinked his eyes. It seems absurd that he should be so weak, so emotional, so like a child, and especially now that everything was over at last. In spite of all their predictions, in spite, too, of his own dreadful certainty that he was going to die, here he was, as fit as a fiddle. But what a fiddle it was, so out of tune, with a long life before him, and to begin with, a voyage to England ordered by the doctor. What could be more delightful? Why should he feel sad about it and want to cry like a baby? In a few minutes, Harry would arrive with his car to take him to the wharf. In an hour, he would be on the sea. In 2 hours, he would see the sun set behind him, where Boston had been, and his new life would be opening before him. It was many years since he had been abroad. June, the best of the year to come. England, France, the Rhine. How ridiculous that he should already be homesick. There was a light footstep outside the door. A knock, the door opened, and Harry came in.
"Well, old man, I've come to get you. The old bus actually got here. Are you ready? Here, let me take your arm. You're tottering like an octogenarian."
Mr. Arcularis submitted gratefully, laughing, and they made the journey slowly along the bleak corridor and down the stairs to the entrance hall. Miss Hoyle, his nurse, was there, and the matron, and the charming little assistant with freckles who had helped to prepare him for the operation. Miss Hoyle put out her hand.
"Goodbye, Mr. Arcularis," she said, "and bon voyage."
"Goodbye, Miss Hoyle, and thank you for everything. You were very kind to me, and I fear I was a nuisance."
The girl with the freckles, too, gave him her hand, smiling. She was very pretty, and it would have been easy to fall in love with her. She reminded him of someone. Who was it? He tried in vain to remember while he said goodbye to her and turned to the matron.
"And not too many latitudes with the young ladies, Mr. Arcularis," she was saying.
Mr. Arcularis was pleased, flattered by all this attention to a middle-aged invalid, and felt a joke taking shape in his mind, and no sooner in his mind than on his tongue.
"Oh, no latitudes," he said, laughing. "I'll leave the latitudes to the ship."
"Oh, come now," said the matron. "We don't seem to have hurt him much, do we?" "I think we'll have to operate on him again and really cure him," said Miss Hoyle.
He was going down the front steps, between the potted palmettos, and they all laughed and waved. The wind was cold, very cold for June, and he was glad he had put on his coat. He shivered.
"Damned cold for June," he said. "Why should it be so cold?"
"East wind,"
Harry said, arranging the rug over his knees.
"Sorry it's an open car, but I believe in fresh air and all that sort of thing. I'll drive slowly. We've got plenty of time."
They coasted gently down the long hill toward Beacon Street, but the road was badly surfaced, and despite Harry's care, Mr. Ocularis felt his pain again. He found that he could alleviate it a little by leaning to the right, against the armrest, and not breathing too deeply. But how glorious to be out again! How strange and vivid the world looked! The trees had innumerable green fresh leaves. They were all blowing and shifting and turning and flashing in the wind. Drops of rainwater fell downward, sparkling. The robins were singing their absurd, delicious little four-noted songs. Even the streetcars looked unusually bright and beautiful, just as they used to look when he was a child and had wanted above all things to be a motorman. He found himself smiling foolishly at everything, foolishly and weakly, and wanted to say something about it to Harry. It was no use, though. He had no strength, and the mere finding of words would be almost more than he could manage. And even if he should succeed in saying it, he would then most likely burst into tears. He shook his head slowly from side to side.
"Ain't it grand?" he said.
"I'll bet it looks good," said Harry.
"Words fail me."
"You wait till you get out to sea. You'll have a swell time."
"Oh, swell. I hope not. I hope it'll be calm."
"Tut, tut."
When they passed the Harvard Club, Mr. Ocularis made a slow and somewhat painful effort to turn in his seat and look at it. It might be the last chance to see it for a long time. Why this sentimental longing to stare at it, though? There it was, with the great flag blowing in the wind, the Harvard seal now concealed by the swift folds and now revealed. And there were the windows in the library, where he had spent so many delightful hours reading Plato and Kipling and the Lord knows what, and the balconies from which for so many years he had watched the marathon. Old Talbot might be in there now, sleeping with a book on his knee, hoping forlornly to be interrupted by anyone for anything.
"Goodbye to the old club," he said.
"The bar will miss you," said Harry,
smiling with friendly irony and looking straight ahead.
"But let there be no moaning," said Mr. Ocularis.
"What's that a quotation from?"
"The Odyssey."
In spite of the cold, he was glad of the wind on his face, for it helped to dissipate the feeling of vagueness and dizziness that came over him in a sickening wave from time to time. All of a sudden, everything would begin to swim and dissolve. The houses would lean their heads together. He had to close his eyes, and there would be a curious and dreadful humming noise, which at regular intervals rose to a crescendo, and then drawlingly subsided again. It was disconcerting. Perhaps he still had a trace of fever. When he got on the ship, he would have a glass of whiskey. From one of these spells, he opened his eyes and found that they were on the ferry, crossing to East Boston. It must have been the ferry's engines that he had heard. From another spell, he woke to find himself on the wharf, the car at a standstill beside a pile of yellow packing cases.
"We're here because we're here because we're here," said Harry.
"Because we're here," added Mr. Ocularis.
He dozed in the car while Harry, and what a good friend Harry was, attended to all the details. He went and came with tickets and passports and baggage checks and porters, and at last he unwrapped Mr. Ocularis from the rugs and led him up the steep gangplank to the deck, and thence, by devious windings, to a small, cold stateroom with a solitary porthole like the eye of a cyclops.
"Here you are," he said. "And now I've got to go. Did you hear the whistle?"
"No."
"Well, you're half asleep. It sounded the all ashore. Goodbye, old fellow. And take care of yourself. Bring me back a spray of Edelweiss, and send me a picture postcard from the Absolute."
"Will you have it finite or infinite?"
"Oh, infinite, but with your signature on it. Now you better turn in for a while and have a nap. Cheerio."
Mr. Ocularis took his hand and pressed it hard, and once more felt like crying. Absurd. Had he become a child again?
"Goodbye," he said. He sat down in the little wicker chair with his overcoat still on, closed his eyes, and listened to the humming of the air in the ventilator. Hurried footsteps ran up and down the corridor. The chair was not too comfortable, and his pain began to bother him again, so he moved, with his coat still on, to the narrow berth and fell asleep. When he woke up, it was dark, and the porthole had been partly opened. He groped for the switch and turned on the light. Then he rang for the steward.
"It's cold in here," he said. "Would you mind closing the port?"
The girl who sat opposite him at dinner was charming. Who was it she reminded him of? Why, of course, the girl at the hospital. The girl with her freckles. Her hair was beautiful, not quite red, not quite gold. Nor had it been bobbed, arranged with a sort of graceful untidiness. It made him think of a Melozzo de Forlì angel. Her face was freckled. She had a mouth which was both humorous and voluptuous. And she seemed to be alone. He frowned at the bill of fare and ordered the thick soup.
"No hors d'oeuvres?" asked the steward.
"I think not," said Mr. Arcularis. "They might kill me."
The steward permitted himself to be amused and deposited the menu card on the table against the water bottle. His eyebrows were lifted. As he moved away, the girl followed him with her eyes and smiled.
"I'm afraid you shocked him," she said.
"Impossible," said Mr. Arcularis. "These stewards, they're dead souls. How could they be stewards otherwise? And they think they've seen and know everything. They suffer terribly from the déjà vu. Personally, I don't blame them."
"It must be a dreadful sort of life."
"It's because they're dead that they accept it."
"Do you think so?"
"I'm sure of it. I'm enough of a dead soul myself to know the signs."
"Well, I don't know what you mean by that."
"But nothing mysterious. I'm just out of hospital after an operation. I was given up for dead. For 6 months, I had given myself up for dead. If you've ever been seriously ill, you know the feeling. You have a posthumous feeling, a mild, cynical tolerance for everything and everyone.
What is there you haven't seen or done or understood?"
"Nothing."
Mr. Arcularis waved his hands and smiled.
"I wish I could understand you," said the girl. "But I've never been ill in my life."
"Never?"
"Never."
"Good God."
The torrent of the unexpressed and inexpressible paralyzed him and rendered him speechless. He stared at the girl, wondering who she was, and then, realizing that he had perhaps stared too fixedly, averted his gaze, gave a little laugh, rolled a pill of bread between his fingers. After a second or two, he allowed himself to look at her again and found her smiling.
"Never pay any attention to invalids," he said, "or they'll drag you to the hospital."
She examined him critically, with her head tilted a little to one side, but with friendliness.
"You don't look like an invalid," she said.
Mr. Arcularis thought her charming. His pain ceased to bother him. The disagreeable humming disappeared, or rather, it was dissociated from himself and became merely, as it should be, the sound of the ship's engines, and he began to think the voyage was going to be really delightful. The parson on his right passed him the salt.
"I fear you will need this in your soup," he said.
"Thank you. Is it as bad as that?"
The steward, overhearing, was immediately apologetic and solicitous. He explained that on the first day everything was at sixes and sevens. The girl looked up at him and asked him a question.
"Do you think we'll have a good voyage?" she said.
He was passing the hot rolls to the parson, removing the napkins from them with a deprecatory finger.
"Well, madam, I don't like to be a Jeremiah, but—"
"Oh, come," said the parson. "I hope we have no Jeremiahs."
"What do you mean?" said the girl.
Mr. Arcularis ate his soup with gusto. It was nice and hot.
"Well, maybe I shouldn't say it, but there's a corpse on board going to Ireland, and I never yet knew a voyage with a corpse on board that we didn't have bad weather."
"Why, Stuart, you're just superstitious. What nonsense!"
"That's a very ancient superstition," said Mr. Arcularis. "I've heard it many times. Maybe it's true. Maybe we'll be wrecked, and what does it matter after all?" He was very bland.
"Then let's be wrecked," said the parson coldly.
Nevertheless, Mr. Arcularis felt a shudder go through him on hearing the steward's remark. A corpse in the hold, a coffin. Perhaps it was true. Perhaps some disaster would befall them. There might be fogs, there might be icebergs. He thought of all the wrecks of which he had read. There was the Titanic, which he had read about in the warm newspaper room at the Harvard Club. It had seemed dreadfully real, even there. That band, playing "Nearer, My God, to Thee," on the after deck while the ship sank. It was one of the darkest of his memories. And the Empress of Ireland, all those poor people trapped in the smoking room, with only one door between them and life, and that door locked for the night by the deck steward, and the deck steward nowhere to be found. He shivered, feeling a draft, and turned to the parson. "How do these strange delusions arise?" he said. The parson looked at him searchingly, appraisingly, from chin to forehead, from forehead to chin. And Mr. Arcularis, feeling uncomfortable, straightened his tie.
"From nothing but fear," said the parson. "Nothing on earth but fear."
"How strange," said the girl.
Mr. Arcularis again looked at her. She had lowered her face, and again tried to think of whom she reminded him. It wasn't only the little freckle-faced girl at the hospital. Both of them had reminded him of someone else. Someone far back in his life. Remote, beautiful, lovely. But he couldn't think. The meal came to an end, they all rose, the ship's orchestra played a feeble foxtrot, and Mr. Arcularis, once more alone, went to the bar to have his whiskey. The room was stuffy, and the ship's engines were both audible and palpable. The humming and throbbing oppressed him. The rhythm seemed to be the rhythm of his own pain. And after a short time he found his way, with slow steps, holding on to the walls in his moments of weakness and dizziness, to his forlorn and white little room. The port had been, thank God, closed for the night. It was cold enough anyway. The white and blue ribbons fluttered from the ventilator. The bottle and glasses clicked and clucked as the ship swayed gently to the long, slow motion of the sea. It was all very peculiar. It was all like something he had experienced somewhere before. What was it? Where was it? He untied his tie, looking at his face in the glass, and wondered, and from time to time put his hand to his side to hold in the pain. It wasn't at Portsmouth in his childhood, nor at Salem, nor in the rose garden at his Aunt Julia's, nor in the schoolroom at Cambridge. It was something very queer, very intimate, very precious. The jackstones, the Sunday school cards which he had loved when he was a child. He fell asleep. The sense of time was already hopelessly confused. 1 hour was like another. The sea looked always the same. Morning was indistinguishable from afternoon, and was it Tuesday or Wednesday? Mr. Arcularis was sitting in the smoking room, in his favorite corner, watching the parson teach Miss Dean to play chess. On the deck outside he could see the people passing and repassing in their restless round of the ship. The red jacket went by, then the black hat with the white feather, then the purple scarf, the brown tweed coat, the Bulgarian mustache, the monocle, the Scotch cap with fluttering ribbons, and in no time at all the red jacket again, dipping past the windows with its own peculiar rhythm, followed once more by the black hat and the purple scarf. How odd to reflect on the fixed little orbits of these things, as definite and profound, perhaps, as the orbits of the stars, and as important to God or the Absolute. There was a kind of tyranny in this fixedness, too. To think of it too much.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?